We are going into this canonical formalism. And so I first go give you basically some basics, which I guess you have heard at some point. So typically, you derive a canonical formalism or canonical theory from a given action. And so let's consider just mechanics. So we have a mechanical system. And then typically, or in the most situations you have known so far, you have given a Lagrangian function of q and the velocity is q dot. And this defines you the action with some final endpoint, which I omit. And then you know that you can get actually the Hamiltonian from this by defining the momentum via a Legendre transform, the derivative of L dq dot, which you also can understand as a variational derivative in this, if you understand this function to be integrated over time, then the momentum at time t is given as a variational differential of your action, actually. Okay, so with the help of this momentum, you know, you can actually do also a Legendre transformation of your Lagrangian and get to the Hamiltonian. And the Lagrangian itself is given by pq dot minus hqp dt. And let me note that for this, it's necessary, if you want to do that, you have to accomplish one thing, namely you have to manage to solve q dot as a function of p and q. So I guess so far you always assumed or you encountered a system where this was possible, but indeed we will have systems where with constraints where exactly this is not always possible. So you find q dot as p and q, and then indeed if you define basically the Hamiltonian as the Lagrangian as p q dot minus the Lagrangian, you have to express every q dot as a function of p and q, so that your Hamiltonian is just a function of q and p. So if you don't manage, you're kind of stuck. Okay. And so the condition for this to be able to do that is actually that there's no that determinant here, but that the second derivative that this doesn't vanish. So for one dimensional system, it's a bit empty, but you can also consider higher dimensional systems. Then you have, I think, such a condition, and these systems are called regular. But okay, here, I actually gave you already one example where you have a first order Lagrangian. Because here you basically have Q and P, and you can actually vary your first order Lagrangian as an action of Q and P. Okay. And of course, you know also Poisson brackets. So here you have basic Poisson brackets, Q and P equal to 1. And so for a function, you have F, G. From this, you can deduce the Poisson brackets between phase-based functions, and it's these things. Okay. So let us actually attempt to take this action now. And we do the same here. We do a canonical analysis of this action, of this first order action. And so we would define the momentum conjugated to Q to be the variational derivative with respect to Q dot. So that's the same formula as here. And we get P. So that's kind of consistent. And then we try to find the momentum associated to P dot. Now you could say, ah, there's no P dot. But indeed, what you have to do is to make a integration by parts of this term. And if you make an integration by parts, you also will have a minus sign, so you find minus q. And indeed, it's basically always this term which gives you the so-called symplectic form or the whatever, the canonical one form, actually, but and defines you the Poisson brackets. So we find that pq is p, so it's also consistent that as I defined, that these are 1, as before. And PP, we found it as minus Q. So these things are all mutually consistent. So we are quite happy. So this is, you know, in principle, you see that you can also do a canonical analysis of a first order action. And it seems to be a bit doubling everything. But this actually tells us that we can also take our first order action and just proceed with our canonical analysis. OK, so I have to make one last remark about these systems. So we have these Poisson brackets, which will be quite important here. And as you know, you typically use them to express your equation of motion. And so they come typically in my conventions as Q, you know, any function, any time evolution of any function being equal to the Poisson bracket of this function with the Hamiltonian. Get some noises. And so this determines you the time evolution of this function. So what does it mean? If you have your phase space here, you know, the Hamiltonian actually defines your orbits in your phase space. And the two orbits are the orbits of your time evolution. So if you have QP here, then solving for Q dot P dot is equal to these right-hand sides, you will find these Hamiltonian evolution orbits, which have some special properties, being all involved with symplectic geometry. And so what you actually do is you define via these Poisson brackets, you actually define a vector field. Sometimes it's called chi h and phase space. And the orbits actually are the orbits of this vector field. And so this vector, the action, you know, a vector field, you can always define a vector field as an action of by how it acts on functions. So as you can guess, it's defined to be to act on a function f by the Poisson brackets. So the Poisson brackets, as you might know, it acts as a derivative. So all these vector fields actually are technically derivatives. And the point is, which is important to see, is that you can take any function. You know, so this all holds not only for the Hamiltonian, but you could take any function. Any function, any phase space function G defines you an associated vector field, and you can integrate these vector fields to orbits. So here you would have vector field chi G. And you know, to actually just put it here, there's a formal solution for this equation. So if you want to solve f dot is equal to f with some phase space function g, Poisson brackets of f and g, it's a first order differential equation, and you can always solve these funny kind of equation by a formal solution, which is a Taylor series. And so if you Taylor expand your solution, then you know that the first derivative, you know, is given by the Poisson bracket of f of g. Then you know that the second derivative, f dot dot, is formally given as f dot, you know, whatever you find in this bracket. So it's given by the Poisson bracket of f dot g. So if you replace f dot with this thing, you find f g g. And so all what I have done is that this is defined to be the iterated Poisson bracket with the index 2 of f and g. So you can guess the general r here indicates the iterated Poisson brackets. Okay. Questions about this?
Little question. When you say that f double dot, you're assuming that g doesn't depend on
indeed
on
t
the
on t. So if you have a yeah indeed that's if you have a time dependent Hamiltonian, then there's always some extra term. You know, so I assume that it's just a phase space function, which means it's it doesn't depend on
okay.
t.
Only depends on P and Q.
Okay. So basically these equations, I mean, at least in principle, it allows you always to find these gauge orbits, the orbits generated by I'll stay here. by a phase space function. And so if you haven't seen it, it's all kind of part of symplectic geometry or phase space geometry. You know, any phase space function always defines you orbits, and this phase space function is constant along the orbits. And there's this, you know, symplectic form which gives you funny geometry in this phase space. And this will play an important role in what we are going to do now. So now we are going to do actually take our great first order action for gravity, which we computed this week. And do our canonical analysis. And the advantage of taking this first order action, as I told you before, is really that it's now quite simple compared to the so-called EDM formalism. So I now multiply my action, whatever I had, with minus 1/2 to be consistent with most of the literature, and to not worry about these factors. So this was our action. We multiplied with something. And so this was our code riot. This is the curvature of our omega, which was defined somewhere. This is the Levi-Civita tensor. So it's something with constant entries. And we don't really need to worry about it if we vary something. And so the thing which we have now to do I forgot something, is to write that to separate spatial and time derivatives. Apparently, yeah. And to do that, I first have to define a bit things. So here we would have, we started with x mu being coordinates from 1 to 2 to 3. So now we say, we assume that our manifold, you know, is actually a manifold which kind of would be the equivalent of this. So we have our manifold M being a so-called spatial hypersurface times the real line. And this real line is our time coordinate. So we just assume that we can split our coordinates in x, a, and t, and a goes from 1 and to 2. So this is the stuff I need to mention. And so to make it simple, so you could make it a bit more complicated and define an embedding or a foliation by some embedding maps of sigma into M, but you get the same result. So I'm not going to do that. Just write, introduce more objects.
Bianca, one question. When we have this canonical formalism classically, there's a distinction between what is time, right, and what are the other coordinates. But in here, if we have an action that is diffeomorphism invariant, then what do I call time evolution?
So let me describe this. So here you have your, and indeed, you know, in the end, all this talk about constraints, we will see that the constraints regain you the notion of you can choose arbitrary time slicing. So indeed, basically now, you know, that's what I'm going. So basically you have to choose, you make a choice, you know. So now you make a choice of your time foliation, basically. So that here you have basically t equal constant slices. So choose some coordinate system so that you have a global time coordinate. That's one assumption here. And these t equal to constant slices will give you some notion of equal time hypersurfaces. And later we will see, you know, so time evolution will be actually the change of your field as you move this time hypersurface. But we will see that there is an arbitrary notion of this movement. So we cannot, you know, we are not only allowed to move it in this pre-chosen way, but it will turn out that we can also just choose to move a small region here. So later we will see that we can change our foliation in this canonical formalism. But for now, we just assume that we have chosen some coordinates of this form. And so we, for this, we need kind of this topology of our manifold that we have a time coordinate here.
So choosing this isn't like fixing your gauge partially somehow?
For now, yes. So for now we do that, and then we see, however, that we have some gauge freedom and in our formalism. Okay, so this will be the important point here is just notational wise I change to Latin indices from Greek indices, which run from 1 to 2. And then another technical point is that if I have my Levi-Civita tensor, okay, so to make our life simpler, I actually use 0, 1, 2 here, and 0 is the time coordinate. And if I have my Levi-Civita tensor in 3D, I can define from it a Levi-Civita tensor in 2D if one of the coordinates is 0. And if it's one of the others, you have to change the sign and so on. okay. So what we have to do now is you might know that from field theory. Because we have to vary here, you see that we need to vary with respect to the time derivatives. So we have to isolate the time derivatives in our action. And so we do that. And at some point, so the only thing which we need to know is the expression of F. And then another thing, which apparently I do, is I rename omega into A. Because for some reason, in the covariant formalism, omega is called omega, and then it's called A in the canonical formalism. So let me, I don't know if we write here, FL mu nu equal to d mu omega L nu minus d nu. So this is an anti-symmetric derivative. And then we have this epsilon coming from this epsilon, which we at some point introduced. And so here we have E times F, and we see that we get a time derivative for these objects, F0A. F0, 0 doesn't exist, and FA0 is minus FA0. And then we get one of these terms will be a time derivative. Okay. So we use this here and call this A. And then you find that you get one component where you actually have a time derivative here, d0 a g epsilon tilde a b. So this comes from this time derivative here. Then you have the other components a b of this curvature tensor. And so in all this, I use a lot basically the property of this Levi-Civita tensor. So the only non-vanishing components is not, you know, if you have some combination of 0, 1, 2. So if these two spatial indices are spatial, then one of them has to be 0. And so here you get only 0 as the only kind of combination. And so if here you have a 0, then you get only a spatial index here. So you never get actually two time indices because of this epsilon here. Okay, and then you get some more terms. And this comes from F0A. And are basically these quadratic terms. So here you have this quadratic term, and here what I did is that I had this term coming from also from F0A, so that, you know, one of this term and one term is this term plus epsilon LJK. So I have this term is given by this term. This term is this term where I made an integration by parts to get the derivative acting on the triad. And then I have this quadratic part here, which is given by this term. And so the easiest part is just this term, which is just the pullback of this term to the spatial hypersurface, where a, b are just equal to the spatial things. And these three terms come all from these terms. And then there are some factors of 1/2 and 2 and so on, because everything is anti-symmetrized and so on. So you get this result, and you integrate also, I guess. OK. So now we, you know, have our action almost in the right form. Let's look at it. Do you notice anything funny? So now we would like to define momenta conjugated to everything. And we would like to define the momenta, you know, by taking the variational derivatives with respect to time derivatives. And now you have to basically find all your time derivatives. And so the only time derivative I see is basically this term. And okay, you could, by integration by parts, you get it on the other term, but then the same happens as before, that you find the same canonical pair that this term is conjugated to A. But we don't find a time derivative for the A0 components. And we don't find a time derivative, yes?
However, you have a partial there on E, right?
There?
Yeah.
It's a spatial derivative.
Oh, well, it's a spatial.
This is an A. No, I did. Yeah. So otherwise, it, so it comes basically again from this Levi-Civita that there's only always one index to be zero. And so we don't find, you know, so you find, you will find that these, this triad, let's say, is some pullback of the triad, or we see some pullback of the dual of the triad. And the connection, the spatial components of the connection are conjugated to each other. But indeed, we don't have anything which comes with a time derivative here. And we don't have anything with a time derivative for the time component of the triad. And so indeed, these things maybe my Lagrange multiplier, which you might know from the theory, I don't know, of varying stuff with respect to constraints. So and so you can already see that you get something funny because you have to still, to find your equation of motion, you have to vary with respect to all fields. So if you vary with respect to E, you get something of this component. You get something simple, namely that F, the spatial components of F is zero, which is great because that's what we wanted to have anyway, so that's not such a problem. And you will find another, another equation of motion or constraint, namely if you vary with respect to AJ0, we will find this thing, which is a torsion component, actually, if you remember. So we define these objects, which will be called fluxes. And these are, you know, to be defined, this, the variational derivatives with respect to the time derivatives of my connection. So these are the objects which will be the momenta conjugated to my connection components. And so if you do this, you get epsilon AB times this triad. So, and these are the momenta. That means that according to my conventions, I have equal time Poisson brackets which are, and note that also all these index positions work out just by all the kind of definitions, because if you take the derivative of something, you get the inverted index positions. So here you get lots of Kronecker's. And in the field theory, you always have also the delta function, x, y. And so technically, you could also worry about these Poisson brackets between components of A, and these are zero. And these things are also zero. Okay, so this is the only canonical pair we get. And we don't get anything canonically conjugated to these things. So that technically we could introduce something which is canonically conjugated, and then we would find that momentum conjugated to A zero components are zero. And then we would have to worry about some other things, which I will explain you in a second. So this we could introduce and then find the same result which we will find now. So I'm just telling you that these components will not be part of our phase space, but they will be basically these Lagrange, they basically act as Lagrange multipliers. And they have some role in the geometry to reconstruct your solution, and we might see that later on. Okay. Okay, so I told you already, you know, so now that you can vary the reaction with respect to something and you get an equation of motion. And so indeed, these things which you get if you vary with respect to the so-called Lagrange multipliers, they are called constraints. So we will encounter our first constraint. And so we will have something called a GJ. And so if you use this definition of capital A, the flux as being this is a dualized triad, then you can rewrite this thing and as so triad times this Levi-Civita will be this derivative of the flux. And then you get an epsilon here, ALE, and triad times this is again a flux, EEM. And you recognize this immediately from Young-Mills theory, maybe, but it's a Gauss constraint. And so in Young-Mills theory, it's basically also what do canonical Young analysis of Young-Mills theory, it's a Young-Mills, it's a Gauss constraint. So you might know this as a Gauss constraint of electrodynamics because you get only this other term for non-abelian theories. And if you rewrite this in back in our original variables, you recognize this as a torsion. Which came with indeed two spacetime indices. So it's a pullback of the torsion contracted with the Levi-Civita thingy tensor. And, you know, so this has to be zero. And so it's completely consistent with the covariant formalism in the sense that we find that this component has to be, you know, it's certain component of the torsion have to be zero. And that's what we also know are the covariant equations of motion. And then we have something called F. And this is the pullback of F. So I just write it to you, the definition of F is this one. And all very symmetric. So this is a pullback of the curvature tensor, again contracted with tilde AB. This contraction doesn't mean anything, actually, because it's just something to get rid of indices, because this F is anti-symmetric. So there's only one component, 1, 2. And T, I forgot, I guess, yeah, it's supposed to be also anti-symmetric, yeah, because it's a 2 form, so it's also anti-symmetric. so this, it just means it's, you have only one spatial component, really, which is independent, and this spatial component has to vanish. And so you get these constraints. And so these are really equations of motions. However, there's something untypical about these equations of motions. To compare to most of the equations of motions, canonical equations of motions you have known so far. Indeed, so there's no time derivatives. That's an important point. So there's no time derivatives. And that's what why these things are called constraints. But you see that, you know, it's nothing which just comes out of the canonical formalism. It's basically just means that the equation of motions which you have, if you restrict them to a hypersurface and try to find, you know, conditions, I mean, solve the equations of motions, you will find that you get conditions on your initial data. And so this is something which is a bit untypical, but it means that before you even can solve your initial, you know, I mean, complete your initial data to a solution, you have to find the right set of initial data. And so in numerical general relativity, it's already a problem a priori to find actually initial data which solve these constraints. And then in the second step, you have actually to time evolve. It just means that there is not the amazingly convenient form of parameterizing your space of solutions. So what we do, it's actually a common trick, use basically more variables than you need. And then, however, we will find these conditions on your initial data. Okay. And so we have our phase space. And in this phase space, you have your constrained hypersurface. Where curly G and curly F is zero. And then you can wonder what happens with all these nice things which come with the phase space. And what comes with the phase space is this notion of Poisson brackets and symplectic structure. And the nice thing is that everything survives in a certain sense. But we will see in which sense it actually survives. So you can define a reduced phase space, but it's not given by your constrained hypersurface. Okay. So we have found kind of initial data. And so the initial data are basically these objects. Pullback or the spatial components of our connection. And these fluxes. And then we know to find a solution to our equation of motion, we first have to actually find pairs of these data which actually solve these constraints. But of course, we need also something else. Namely, time evolving, yes.
going back to the original action,
mm-hmm.
the original origin, do we have a square root of g hiding inside the epsilon?
In the epsilon tilde?
Yeah.
No. In this big epsilon tilde. So, I mean, it's a tensor density. So if you write it, there's no square root of g. But if you transform it, there's a square root of g appearing. And otherwise, you know, as we computed this expression from the Einstein-Hilbert action, then the square root of g was kind of transformed into this triad thing. But yeah, it's just this, luckily. And it also works out form wise. So what you integrate there is this reform. Yeah. So in the end, this is all just a reform, E which F. Okay. And this means that you can integrate it without any square roots of G. Okay, so we have our initial data, and we see that these need to satisfy these conditions. And to find our full solution, we need to time evolve the initial data. Yeah.
I was thinking when you have these constraints, is it obvious from there that it had to that they have to follow for every time?
It's not obvious, but that's what I wanted to say to conclude. I think. So indeed, I mean, it's not obvious, but you could. Maybe it's obvious. So the initial data, of course, if you time evolve, you get new initial data. So to be consistent, they have to satisfy the constraints. But it's a condition which you get on the constraints. So typically, what you would, you know, what I wanted to say is that okay, we check our time evolution of our initial data, and this time evolution should be such that the constraints are preserved. And if they would not have been preserved, we would have to add new constraints so that you constrain to the subset of constraints, to the subset of the constraint hypersurface, which satisfies all these constraints. And if these are not preserved, you would have to add new constraints and so on. And you go on until you find a consistent set, or find basically that your consistent set is zero, dimensional zero. And this is called, it's not really, I mean, it's Dirac hyper. So we will have this easy case where actually these constraints will be automatically satisfied. And these constraints are also called first class constraints. And actually, I was a bit lying. If the constraints are not satisfied, there's two options. Either you have new constraints, or you find actually that they are only satisfied for certain Lagrange multipliers. So you fix your Lagrange multipliers. And this case is called second class constraints. And but we will have, for now, only these first class constraints. So we have to write, our time evolution, we have to write our Hamiltonian. And so we will see another thing, some funny thing appearing. Just have to. And so to motivate what this Hamiltonian is, I'm also doing a shortcut here. So if you check there, very, very above us, we wrote this first order thing, and it was pq dot minus Hamiltonian. So we do the same thing here. Here we have our pq dot term, and everything else will be our Hamiltonian. And so we have curly h comes with a minus. And in principle, we can write it with these Lagrange multipliers now. And so some, you know, people usually don't write these Lagrange multipliers in their original geometrical form so that you would recognize them, but they write them with some other letters. And so you could call that Nj, and this lambda j to just call them something different as objects which really don't actually depend on this, at least on the phase space we defined. And so you see something very funny, namely that the Hamiltonian, Hamiltonian is a combination of constraints. It vanishes on the constraint hypersurface. And as we learned in the colloquium, this means that gravity is holographic, which is a bit too much for me, but yeah. So you know, it actually already tells you that gravity, you will have a problem in defining a notion of energy for gravity. It's not very obvious because your Hamiltonian is basically zero on the set of initial data which you can solve. And so defining mass and energy, it's all a bit subtle, but basically it requires all these things which we haven't discussed at all, namely boundaries and asymptotic conditions and so on. And then you could do it. Okay, so it's a combination of constraints, and these things are called the Hamiltonian, totally constrained systems, which is a bit funny, but and actually it turns out that all diffeomorphisms in invariant systems and even some simpler systems, so all systems where you have a free choice of your time variable are of this type, namely the Hamiltonian will be a combination of constraints. And you could worry now, what does it mean? It has to be zero, so the Hamiltonian doesn't do anything. But actually, you don't need the Hamiltonian to give you something, because this usually, you know, the Hamiltonian is preserved anything anyway. It gives you maybe a number, but in this case, the number is zero. But it should give you these orbits. And so indeed, even if your Hamiltonian is zero for these initial data, it doesn't mean that this Hamiltonian doesn't generate you anything interesting. And so indeed, we will see that it will generate. So now I have this funny picture, which is a bit useless. So if your constraint type, if this is your constraint hypersurface and now it's a plane, it will generate orbits according to so the orbits are actually very high dimensional if you allow arbitrary Lagrange multipliers. And the question which we will have to answer which comes from your question is whether these orbits are actually inside the constraint hypersurface or not. So if they are just inside the constraint hypersurface, then, you know, they don't leave the hypersurface which is defined by having vanishing Hamiltonians. And if they go out, then we would have to think what to do. And to add something, you have to be careful. I told you this is the Hamiltonian. You know, it's basically that you have infinitely many Hamiltonians. And so what you actually have, because you can make an arbitrary choice of your Lagrange multipliers. And so what you actually have is for every spatial point, you find you know, basically 6 times number of spatial points. It's a very unprecise notion. parameters for choosing your Hamiltonian. And so we to tell you that it's really this free choice of n and lambda regains all possible time evolutions and all possible slicings you can basically imagine for choosing your time. So the coordinate freedom is now inside this free choice of Lagrange multipliers you can do. But of course, this is a, you know, you have lots of consistency conditions which come from this because so all these Hamiltonians have to be zero. And then what you want is that under arbitrary evolution choice of these Lagrange multipliers, you want that these conditions are actually satisfied. And these are very non-trivial conditions. And they will lead us to the constraint algebra. I guess more or less tomorrow. And this constraint algebra, it reflects, or it should give you actually the algebra of, in this case, gauge symmetries. And so if these things are violated in quantum theory, one speaks of an anomaly. So that is not good because it usually means that you cannot satisfy your constraints consistently, at least in quantum theory. But basically, to tell you why is it important, so constraint algebra means we have now to check whether h n lambda, so if you take h n lambda and evolve it with h n prime lambda prime, we want that these constraints, that the constraint hypersurface is preserved or that the flow doesn't really leave the constraint hypersurface. So we want this to be takes a lot. So you don't need zero because you only need zero on the constraint hypersurface. So that means that you only need something which comes as a combination of H again. And so you could have any complicated combination appearing here. But nicely, funnily, I don't know, typically what you get is that you get something where you get really an algebra. And that basically means that you manage to choose your generators nicely. And so you get n prime prime as a functional of n prime. In principle, this, but we will have even something simpler. N prime n lambda lambda prime. And so the constraint algebra will be basically the relation, these relations, n prime prime as a function of these other gauge parameters. And this is a certain calculation which we have to do, or you do, or whatever. And it's nice to do that once in your life. And again, we are lucky because in the case of our choice of flatness constraints, the most complicated, you know, the part which is most complicated, is extremely easy in this case. But as I guess you will can later read in the script, there's another choice of combinations of these constraints, which is more connected to the geometry. And this is called hypersurface deformations. So they really deform the hypersurface, and they have a much more complicated algebra. And I won't go through it, but you can read it in the script. And it's very nice geometric interpretation and gives you in the limit basically the Poincaré algebra. OK, so I guess next time I will at least tell you shortly about that you get a consistent algebra there. And you can think over the weekend why you get a consistent algebra, at least for the flatness constraints. Did I tell you? So these are called Gauss constraints. Gauss, depending on the German letter, constraints, and these are called flatness constraints. And so the flatness constraints have an extremely simple algebra, and the Gauss constraints have a simple algebra. Okay, so thank you.